Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in actor, producer, director, and passionate health advocate, Mr. Charles Maddox. Charles, welcome.
Thank you for having me, brother.
We're really grateful to have you here. Yeah. I know that you've had a lot go on in your career, from making tracks with LL Cool J to now taking on this health advocacy thing full force with the talents you've got. So I want to get to today, but I want you to kind of rewind me to the point where you're at in your life. I don't know if it's a happening or a person around you that kind of gave you this license to dream big like this and do these things.
You know, and you didn't mention nephew of Bob Marley.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, I think because I had met him twice before he passed.
Okay.
And I kind of got an inspiration from him, because it was like, I knew I had some blood inside of me and that I needed to do something special. What that was, I didn't know. And I think at that point, I was watching I Need Love on Video Music Box.
Nice.
Old school Video Music Box.
Yeah.
And I said, man, how can somebody live like this? I mean, you know, you see him coming out the LL coming out the limo and with all the ladies. And I'm like, man. So at that point I said, I need to find this guy. I lived in Long Island.
And how old were you at this point?
Man, I don't even remember. 16, 15 or something like that. I knew I was close to driving. So I said, you know what? I'm gonna find this guy. So I lived in Long Island. He lived in Farmers, which was, you know, maybe 35, 40 minutes away from me. And I just literally, I think at that point, I just bought my little first car. And I just went to Farmers Boulevard.
Yeah.
I asked, where does LL Cool J live? And, you know, a couple of people say, you know, go down this way, go down that way, so on and so forth. Ended up finding out where his grandmother lived. That's where he was kind of living a little bit here and there, and knocked on the door. And grandmother came out, he ain't here, you know what I'm saying? But I was like, I'm relentless. You know, I'm coming back. And then one day I came back and he was actually there. He was getting into a limo, him and E-Love, who used to be his DJ, who's like my brother. And I just walked up to him. And he was saying, let me hear something. And, you know, I'm shaking, nervous.
Right.
Went back to my car to get my wraps. I'm like, you know, and he was like, man, I like you. I like what you're doing. You know, come check me again. And he was, I guess, going on tour. So I would come back every week, you know, same thing. Grandmother, he ain't here. You know? And then one day I came back and dude was there. And she said, hold on. And took me down into the basement, man. And we was just vibing down there. And that was the start of the reality of putting something together. And we just became good friends. We made music together. Would live with him time to time. And it was interesting because, you know, he didn't really know what I was dealing with.
Right.
And we would literally, me and my boy Boogie would jump, you know, the train, the turnstile. We had little money and we'd go over to his house and we'd have great times. We'd even do shows at the tunnel or whatever and literally have to go back and jump the same turnstile because we didn't have the money to get back to Long Island, you know? But so that was really the start of wanting to do something special and then having focus and then making my own music, you know. He actually said to me at one point, this is when he was making She's Rocking, you know. And he said, yo, when my album come out, and if it does good, I'm going to get you a deal. And at that point, I was just so hot and on fire. I was like, man, I'm not waiting around for you to get me a deal. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm going out there and continuing what I needed to do, you know. So I kind of went and did my own thing with E-Love, and that really worked out really well, you know, so.
And what was that like? When did you start performing? Did you?
Well, initially with him, you know, I mean, I was just put into the fire, but yeah, I was a young kid.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, right. I mean, I'm like, yeah, let's do it. You know?
So ambition's taking over any nerves at this point.
Oh, man, I'm not even thinking about that. You know,
I'm
with LL Cool J. We're at like the world famous tunnel, you know, and we're performing. And it was a beautiful thing. But then what I did was I teamed up with E-Love. E-Love had some contacts back then. He connected me to a lady named Angela Thomas, who was like a really big exec at Sony. Uh-huh. She ended up taking my project to Russell Simmons.
Nice.
Russell Simmons ended up offering me a deal. Fred Davis was my lawyer, which was Clive Davis's son.
Right.
That didn't work out because I wanted a little bit more money than Russell was wanting to give me. But even with that was something, because I used to run up on Russell all the time and beg him for a deal, Russell, you know, and he would ignore me and never pay me any mind. But then because of Angela, you know, he actually took some time to listen to my work. So, and then that led to a deal with Tommy Boy Records. You know, Tommy Boy had Naughty by Nature,
of course,
RuPaul, House of Pain.
Yes.
You know, so we released a single on there. And that was the start. I mean, I think, you know, the whole music thing was just wanting to do something special. I didn't know what it was. And then that led to, you know, voiceovers and then eventually film and TV and starring television shows, you know, and movies. So,
well, when you're at this point and you're having to rely more on your relentlessness to get your foot in a door, mm-hmm. where does this relentlessness come from? Did someone tell you, hey, you got to keep putting your foot in the door? Or was this just like the instinct of I'm not going away?
You know what? I don't even know. I don't even know, you know, because I was relentless, bro.
Yeah.
You know,
sounds like it.
You know, this was a heck of a career. I mean, this, you know, we've had some amazing times and came up at the right time with so many people. You know, this was the time when Diddy was really just getting his, you know, everything off. This was the time of EPMD where everybody was really rocking.
Yes.
And actually Eric Sherman from EPMD, that's who was going to actually produce my album with Russell. So Russell was like, yo, go in there and make him songs. But, you know, I didn't want Eric, you know, making music for me, because I already had my own thing going on and I didn't want to be like a manufactured, you know, having E make songs that, you know, he maybe co-wrote and all this kind of stuff like that.
Right.
So in hindsight, it's 2020, you know, I'd have probably looked back. Maybe I would have had E make two or three songs just to see what it took, where they were at.
Right.
Because E is a heck of a producer, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know where it came from. Honestly, I think that, you know, it's like my uncle, coming from the ghetto of Trenchtown, you know, where does that hustle come from?
Exactly.
Where does that desire come from? Because for him to make it out of that, I mean, that's almost impossible. You know, I was at least in America and had the resources, somewhat of the resources as far as my parents and stuff. So, like I said, I think because of what he did, I realized that there was something in me. And I wanted to do something special, you know? Yeah.
So as you're doing music and it, regardless of where it goes, it's something special for you, for a person to make, even if no one hears it.
Exactly.
So you're getting that little bit off. You're starting to feel that feeling a little bit. You're getting that part of your lives and desires off the ground. What's it like when you start to think about transitioning out of that? Was that a slow thing or was that a hard left? I'm going to get into acting now.
You know what? It was... And it was a heck of a career all behind that, because we got into radio. So my so-called manager that came on board, his name was Star, right? Mm-hmm. Star ended up going to do radio in New York. We ended up having the biggest radio show in New York.
Nice.
Hot 97.
Nice.
Star was making millions of dollars. Our first DJ, when we were at the radio station in the college radio station, was DJ Clue.
Oh, snap.
Yeah. So you know DJ Clue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's funny, Clue used to pick us up at in Jamaica at the bus stop train station and take us to Long Island. I think by the time I started to get into film, because like you said, when the single was released, you know, it wasn't pushed the way it should have been pushed, so on and so forth. Hindsight, I look back, there was probably a couple of things I should have done and differently, maybe a different single I would have wanted to release. But like you said, it was really about getting there.
Right.
It wasn't so much about, man, I needed to be the biggest rapper or anything. It was more saying, you know what, man, I got there. And the ride has been amazing. But I wanted to transition because I didn't want to just be known as a rapper.
Right.
And Angela was really well connected in the business. And my dream, because I had my first son, Amani, my dream was to be on Sesame Street.
And how old were you at that point?
I don't remember. Like I said, somewhere around 20 or something like that, you know?
Okay. So, cause this is an odd parallel. I got a rap career that's been, it's in its places, but you know what? I want to be on Sesame Street.
And I was rocking. Everything was fantastic, man. Yeah. I was making, you know, songs with all kind of people and traveling and doing shows but I wanted something different. So I asked her about being on, you know, if she had any hookups or anything.
At Sesame Street specifically.
Just a way to maybe an agent or a manager.
Gotcha.
She ended up having a good friend who was like huge at CAA, which is one of the biggest talent agencies in the world. And went in there, man, and they were like, yeah, we'd love to work with you. And I knew nothing. So they would call me, be like, Charles, you got to come pick up these sides. I'd be like, pick up sides? What? So sides are part of a script, you know, that you kind of memorize, you know? And that just started taking off, you know, because then I was young, I was, you know, better looking, you know, fresh face, you know.
Energetic.
Yeah, energetic.
Doubly energetic.
Exactly. And it wasn't that competition. You know, I mean, you back then it was, you know, you go on an audition, it wasn't a whole lot of people that looked like me because getting an agent back then was really hard. Especially one at CAA. Which one of the top, you know, in the business. And then when you're repped by CAA, you walk in differently because they may rep the director, they may rep the producer. So you might skip past the casting director and go right to producer. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or they may say, listen, we want to put Charles in this little small role. So, you know, let him get that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you're young, you know, how you read lines is very organic and natural and fun. So I started to book these roles. You know, I booked them. I think my first one was Fly By Night. That was with Daryl Chill Mitchell, MC Light.
Oh, nice.
A bunch of other really well names that everybody went off to do big things right now, you know?
Yeah.
And then from there was my second role, which was my biggest one. The second one was Daybreak with Cuba Gooding Jr. And Omar Epps. And then the biggest one was I played the title role with James Woods and Elizabeth McGovern in a film called The Summer of Ben Tyler.
Nice.
Never got on Sesame Street.
No? Well, there's still time.
I didn't even read for it. You know what I mean? I didn't even read for it. But that was my goal because I wanted my son to see me because he was young. And I was like, man, it would be so cool to have my son see me on Sesame Street. And at that point, Morgan Freeman was rocking Sesame Street because that's how Morgan started.
Right.
Yeah, Sesame Street.
So when you're having these things happen, especially when you get this title role, are you thinking to yourself, acting is my home, acting is where I'm going to stay now. This feels like, you know, I'm getting more of that itch to make that contribution.
Yeah. You know,
scratched.
And I hope everybody that's watching and listening really understand. It wasn't until a lot of failure that I realized that I needed to take it serious and that this was actually a thing. Because I would go in front of like Lynn Kressel. Lynn Kressel is one of the biggest casting directors in the world. She cast Spider-Man. She cast Shawshank Redemption. She cast, no, Deborah Quillett. She cast all the major movies that you could imagine. Still Deborah Quillett, still to this day.
Dang.
And I used to go in there. I remember the last audition. And these were like for parts that could change your life.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could make millions of dollars. And I have this opportunity. And when I say the last time I went in there for an audition, I didn't study, I didn't read it, I didn't. And she was almost begging me to get it right. And I remember just screwing it up and saying, walking out of there and saying, never again, I got to stop this. I got to take this thing serious. So the next role came up and that was Daybreak. And I'm shocked she even had me back because I was that bad. You know what I mean?
And why do you think she had you back? What impression do you think you made on her?
She saw something that maybe I didn't see.
Right.
The naturalness, but I didn't take it serious.
Ah.
So I wasn't studying it. So the next time I said, you know what? I'm gonna nail this. So we went literally into a room. It was like this, dark, just like this. And it was just me and her. And literally almost brought her to tears. And that's when it clicked that I had to actually take this thing serious and not just go on looks or that the idea that I had a great agent or that, you know, it was just given. Mm-hmm. And at that point, yeah, I realized that I had something. And, you know, it was a beautiful thing. When I came back from doing the summer of Ben Tyler, I met with, I can't forget his name. I can't remember his name, but he had passed. He was a big casting director. He casted Gladiator. And they literally just gave me the role to play Oprah's husband in Beloved. And had a beautiful cast read through with Oprah, Sam Jackson, Jonathan Demme, who directed Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. They ended up changing the role in the film, but just that experience alone, you know, it was like, you know, you were in the right places. I was doing the right thing. I booked a film with Sylvester Stallone. I had to turn that down because of other roles that came up. I think where it changed and diverted was when I moved to Los Angeles, because I was this hot thing in New York. Then going to LA, I was like, just, I got to get in where I fit in, you know? And I still booked as soon as I got there. I booked a film with Mario Lopez, a boy called The Journey Absolution, Richard Grieco. The little pretty thing that I had a big crush on her. Man, what's her name? I can't remember her name. But yeah, it's been a beautiful ride.
So when you get to Los Angeles and you realize you got to shift gears a little bit, did it feel like something new, or did it feel like no I got to rely on the old relentless? I got
the old hustle. It was the old hustle. So like, you know, I ran up on back then she was a big manager, Holly Robinson's mother convinced her to manage me, and she was huge. She had Daniel Day-Lewis back then. I had another big manager wanting to manage me. It was the same hustle. But I had to restart the hustle. Whereas in New York, I was already that person, you know? And that was a little trying and a little difficult, but you know, I was right in the mix with everything. I think one of the biggest disappointments was the original CSI. Mm-hmm. That literally was my role. I went in, read for that, rocked them, and they gave me dates. Cause when you have dates, that means that, you know, that's your role. We're gonna shoot on June, whatever it is, so mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. forth. Then they ended up giving it to Gary. Gary is kind of reminds, he kind of looks like me a little bit, but he was in like Janet Jackson video, the light skinned guy with the braids. So they ended up giving it to him at the last minute, which was, heartbreaking. Cause I was literally at that point, I remember being on my boat and I called my manager. I'm like, yo, what's going on? It's been like 2 weeks, you know, what was it? She said, well, let me call to see what's going on. And, you know, when I look back at that now, that would have been a game changer because CSI was one of the biggest shows on television.
Right.
And for me to have had that lead role, you know, would have been everything, you know? So, yeah. And it's funny because I went to his house, you know, probably a couple of years later, man. And I'm like, dude, this dude is living in my house. You
You're
know,
right,
it's
right.
This big, beautiful house in Venice Beach. And I'm like, man, this is mine. I didn't even tell him that, you know, that was supposed to be my role, but you know.
So when you get to LA, what keeps you hungry to the point to get to something like that? And then what keeps you hungry through something like that?
You know, I didn't have anything else to lean on. You know, I mean, that was it. I didn't have parents that were like, you know, going to take care of me or, you know, there was no plan B. There was no plan.
Okay, so then now we're going to, I don't normally do this, but you said the magic word in plan B. How do you feel about plan Bs?
Nah, I don't do plan Bs. I don't do plan Bs. You know, I think Eddie Murphy said the same thing. He said, you know, there was no plan B for him. You know, this was it. I, you know, because if you have a plan B, and don't get me wrong, it may work for somebody else.
Yeah, right.
But if you have a plan B, at times people don't put 150% in plan A. Mm. But you also can't fool yourself on plan A, right?
What do you mean by that?
I wasn't the best rapper, but I could make a song, right? And I had my look, I had a few things going for me. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't trying to battle Nas, you know what I'm saying? So you can't fool yourself in what you are and what your real talents are. You won't catch me, can I keep a note? I can, but you're not gonna catch me on American Idol. if you're not the best drummer, but you're decent, you know, you may not play for the Foo Fighters. You may have a small little band, but so I knew what my talents were and I knew what my strengths were. And I focused on that and made that work. But if you got a plan B, and sometimes plan A diverts also into different things because, you know, while I was around all of these people in Hollywood and everything, you know, I looked and I said, okay, well, you know what? I need to work that not just behind being in front of the camera, but there are opportunities where you could be behind the camera, you know? So plan A can have a metamorphosis also, you know? But yeah, I knew there was no other way to do it, but to go out there and get it, you know? And it's a beautiful ride. It's a beautiful journey. The failure at times is just as good as the success. You know, because, you know, if you look at the failures bring us one step closer to that yes, right? Every no brings us one step closer to that yes. So I looked at that and I'm like, you know what, man, this is, I'm having fun. This is a good ride. I'm meeting a ton of people. Life is good. I'm in Los Angeles. I can't complain.
Is that an attitude or mentality that you feel like you inherently had in these situations just gave you a chance to apply? Or do you think that's something that you learned from these situations along the way?
I think a combination of both. Because, you know, I mean, just picking up and if you look when it started, just picking up and getting in the car and driving to LL Cool J's house.
Right.
Knowing that, you know, that this man could tell me to get away from him. You know, made me
say. That's what he has grandma for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, and even her, he ain't here, you know.
Right.
That didn't stop me from wanting what I wanted, you know. So it's an amazing thing when you think about that, you know, you're able to look at it in that vein. And I think that, you know, people who are successful, you know, that's how they think about it. I mean, I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg, I'm sure, you know, Elon Musk, you know, came upon, you know, roadblocks that were just, you know, things that you thought it could never happen.
Right.
You know, you could never get over this, but you do. And it's a joyful ride, you know?
That's Amor Fati.
Yeah.
That's the stoicism creeping its way in. Uh-huh. Okay, so you got the acting game going. You've persevered some things. CSI eludes you, but you're not out of the game.
Yeah.
So where does the road start to take you from there? Because you don't stay there.
Yeah. And that's interesting because, you know, I don't know what I was living this fantastic life in Los Angeles and my brother was in Tampa. Mm. My mother was in Ocala and some wild hair came up and said, man, I want to move out that way. I don't know why. Sometimes I look back now and I'm like, dude, what were you thinking? You know what I mean? I mean, why would you leave on top of the game when you could have, you know, you had a great manager, you had a great agency. Life was fantastic. I had, you know, a boat. I had the new Jeeps. I had the place in Venice. I had the ladies, you know what I'm saying? I mean, but I decided that I wanted to do that. And wanted to be a single dad, brought my son out here with me. And then I kind of figured out something else to do, You know, my son came up with this idea about healthy meals for $7 or something like that. And that kind of took me on this whole.
Then how old was he at this point?
He was about six.
Okay, yeah, so the apple's not falling far from the tree at all.
No. He's doing well too. But and that kind of led me into this whole celebrity chef thing. I wasn't a chef. I would go and let other people do the cooking.
Right.
But the trick was you had to cook a healthy meal all for under $7 for two people or more. So that kind of opened me up to sauces and cookbooks and all of this stuff like this. And then throughout this so-called healthy journey, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And that kind of took me on this whole path of creating television shows and documentaries on health and all of this stuff. And now where I'm at today, where I'm producing, you know, television shows, big TV shows that air on networks like Discovery and PBS and stuff like that on health. So that it was another pivotal moment of me being diagnosed with diabetes that led me on a different journey.
So in this window between when you come here and your son offers you this idea and you find out that you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, were you looking at the cooking as a way to get back in front of the camera and you were going to do these as like tutorials or, you know, just to propagate how we can eat well for less? This was a way to use your old skill with something new? Or was this just a straight out hard left, another timeline?
You know what's interesting? I don't even like being in front of the camera.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really don't. I mean, and people who actually, if you hear a lot of people like, you know, when I do a film, I don't even watch it. And there's a couple other famous people as well. They don't even watch themselves. They don't right. like, they don't like looking at themselves.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. So I think I did it because I had no choice but to do it. Because if I got to get the ball from point A to point B, brother, I gotta put myself out there.
Right.
So it wasn't a thing of me wanting to be in front of the camera. And even now I've kind of pulled back from that. And it's like, you know, sometimes I wonder, man, I could be a whole lot further because everybody's in front of the camera now. And
exactly.
Here I am trying to pull back from it. But now I'm like, dude, you got to get back in front of it because if you're selling what you're selling and times have changed, the world has changed. You got to be in front of that camera. So I didn't really want to be in front of the camera, but I knew that I had to get the ball where it had to go.
Right.
And I had to sell it. And I think I was still young enough where it was still fun to me, you know? And once again, I called up, I think it was NBC, no, CBS. Called up the general manager and I said,
showed him at his door.
Literally, I said, yeah. I got an idea. And he loved it. He said, Charles, you know what? Yeah, I want to do a segment with you.
And this idea was
they called it the poor chef.
Okay.
And he said, yeah, you know, right now we're in election period. And as soon as that election period is over, boom, we're going to get you doing a segment. And once again, I had no time to wait on him, you know?
So this is a theme.
Yeah. I went to NBC locally in Tampa and pitched the idea. And they said, yeah, let's have you do a weekly segment. So I ended up doing this weekly segment for almost a year out there. And that, you know, was a once again, you know, relentless and flipped that into a lot of things. And then from there,
and what were you thinking when that started? When you start doing this weekly segment? Because I'm curious if at any point in this journey you're thinking to yourself, there, now I'll do this now.
Yeah.
Does it ever feel like you're not going to transition out of things? Or does everything kind of have the I'm here now, but I'm going somewhere feel to it to you?
It was definitely I'm here, but I'm going somewhere. Because I didn't want to be known as that. Even though that put me on Dr. Oz. That put me on the Today Show twice. You
nice.
Know, that was cookbook sauces, spice lines, all of that stuff.
Nothing
like
you
that.
Saw coming.
Nothing. I said, bro, you know, I mean, spice lines.
That's
and sauces.
Why I'm wondering what this feels like.
No, definitely not. It was a hustle, you know, but it was once again, it was a fun ride.
Because yeah.
Remember at that point, I feel like I'm, what's his name from, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, Catch Me If You Can?
Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah.
Because I'm not the chef. But I'm called the poor chef.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I got other people cooking, but then sometimes I would have to because it was called a poor chef. So literally I'd have to go on the Today Show and I wasn't a good cook. I'd have to go on the Today Show and make these recipes. So I'd have to literally practice and prep these things. But it was more, the personality was there.
Right.
So that I used that to carry those segments. Of course, I ended up putting the meal together because anybody could put, but it was really about the personality and the moment and this, once again, I wasn't the best. So I focused on what I did well, which was more personality than the cooking. You know,
is it easy for you to have those self-examination moments where you can say to yourself, hey, I might not be the best cook, but I can cook well enough that my personality that I do have in spades is going to carry this. Yeah. Is it easy for you to be honest or self-critical or whatever like that when you're creating the how you're going to do this? Or is every time does it make you kind of squirm?
You know, I was really good at acting, really good at acting. And I wish that I would have stayed in that. Because the opportunities that I had were tremendous because I wasn't pigeonholed into one thing. I mean, I turned down roles because I'm like, I don't want to be portrayed as that.
Right.
So the roles that I had in front of me were very different. My first agent, that wasn't Angela. It was Michael T. Williamson, who played Bubba and Forrest Gump. And
I was going to say, I know that name.
Yeah, I actually stayed with him and lived with him. He flew me out to San Francisco. I was around those types who, you know, were able to transform and not just be one particular thing.
Right. Important.
Exactly. And that's why I wish I would have stayed because I look at the roles that I could have done even now, which wouldn't have been the typical roles. You know, I didn't want to be the black guy who was in a gang and shooting or anything like that. I wanted to be Forrest Gump. I wanted to be a whatever it might be, you know? So, and those were the roles that I was getting. You know, so but no, I mean, you sometimes you got to fake it till you make it, you know, and so as far as that whole thing, the chef thing, it was more of let me run with this. Once again, I wasn't the star of it per se, but if I had to jump in and do it,
at least you were there
and
comfortable.
To jump in and do it. You know what I mean? So,
okay. So then you hit the point where you get the diagnosis of the diabetes.
Yeah.
Does this feel ironic to you at this point? Is this touching like way too much? Like you've got to be kidding me.
Well, the diagnosis was, it was something that was life shaking and I was scared to death. I was going to die, you know, I'm diagnosed with something, you know?
Right.
And then I said, you know what? I want to do a documentary. I had no clue how to do a documentary. I had no idea anything with this. And then I started to reach out to doctors in Orlando and say, hey, listen, I'd love for you to sponsor a documentary. And
just straight cold calling.
Yeah, just straight. And then I reached out to a pharmaceutical company, a big pharmaceutical company, Shire, and I pitched them on the idea. And they cut me a nice check. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go around and I'm going to find some people to shoot me and tell this story. And that led to everything kind of progressing as far as me creating this documentary and then also creating the television series.
Did you do those in lockstep or was one then the other?
It was the documentary first. Once again, I had no idea what I was doing with the documentary.
And what was the documentary titled?
The Diabetic You.
Okay.
And so by the time I came up with the idea for the television series, it's a docu-reality series where we bring five people who have diabetes, bring all these experts. I had met a crew that was shooting the documentary. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, listen, I'm putting some money in. Let's shoot this bad boy. Ended up shooting this really nice trailer. I ended up finding a guy named Chad, who I still work with now, who, you know, works with networks. And I said, hey, Chad, here, you know, he said, here's the trailer. And I said, he said, well, Charles, I like it. And, you know, let me shop it. He said, if something happens, you know, it usually takes a couple of months or whatever like that for a network, you know, to if they're interested. And literally 2 weeks later, he's like, Charles, Discovery's interested. And I'm like, whoa, okay. And now at this point, I'm like, now what? You know, so I had to literally figure out a way to fund this because I had the trailer. I had no funding for the whole series.
Right.
So I literally just locked myself away for like two, 3 weeks, calling everyone that I could imagine that I had met along the way, begging everybody in healthcare and thinking that it was going to be a whole lot easier than it was. And because, you know, especially when you think about diabetes, because once again, I'm naive to the healthcare system.
Right.
And I thought that people were going to part the Red Seas and they're going to be like, but the show is number one, it's called Reversed. In a time where people didn't talk about reversing diabetes and that was taboo. If you even mentioned something like that, it was like, you're crazy, you know? And
the nature of that was just the business of insulin?
Well, you know, nobody wants to, you know, there's big money in diabetes, billions, right?
Right.
And if you're talking about reversing diabetes and taking away medication or even reducing medication, who do you think wants to support you?
Yeah, right.
You know, so when you talk about everything from testing companies to the morgue, everybody benefits from somebody who's sick. And if you're talking about reversing, then nobody wants to support that. You know, that's how people make their money. Mm. And then the last, I think toward the end, a lady said, hey, Charles, I know somebody who might be interested. And it was a big company called Mankind that makes inhaled insulin. And got on the phone with the CEO, sold him on it. He said, yeah, I'm down. Of course, stayed on him, you know, and he ended up cutting check, and we shot that first series in Jamaica, and it's been history ever since, you know.
So what did that feel like when you finally got the call? We're going to do this.
It was surreal because once again, it was a lot of money. Before, I mean, back then, yeah, I mean, that wasn't that long ago, but it was like $500,000. And once again, I still didn't know what I was doing. I had never directed and produced a television series before or wrote a television series before. So I had to literally write this thing out, crew it up, get location, put all of this stuff together, get the guest, figure out how to shoot this thing to make it make sense. But I had it all in my head.
So I guess this is almost full circle to my first question. This is one of those moments where I always get curious when people say stuff like that. What gave you the confidence to do that?
Once again, I didn't know anything else. I mean, if you trace it back to growing up the way I did and coming up with running up on LL and stuff like that, this is all I knew. This is all I knew. I didn't know anything else. You know, there was no failure. There was no room for failure. I mean, and I also believe it's like this. If I'm standing at Mount Everest and I believe I can climb it, it's only until someone says, man, 3-4 people died here last week that may take me back and say, you know what? Ooh, maybe I can't do it. You know, so I try to stay around people who definitely don't steal your dream, right? Because if you believe that you can't do something because somebody else couldn't do it or there was failure in front of you or behind you, then it will make you, you know, pause.
Right.
But if you don't know that it can't be done, then you do it.
So then I guess the follow-up question to that one is, how do you maintain an attitude or mentality that lets you see things in the splay of possibility instead of the splay of what can stop me?
You know, a good buddy of mine, this was when I was in LA. He taught me a lot too. His name is Tony Romano, right? And back then when I knew Tony, he was like a Jewish guy who had done some time for the stock market stuff, you know? But he was a hustler. Mm. I mean, he was a hustler. And I remember he set me up with a meeting with one of the biggest lawyers in the business in Manhattan, in Los Angeles. I show up there, brother. I don't have a dime on me. And we're at this fancy restaurant. I had a 1970 Pontiac. It wasn't Pontiac Le Mans. I parked it down the street because it wasn't fixed up. Walked into this restaurant. I think I seen Ben Stiller, one of those people in there. And I'm sitting there like nervous because I'm like, man, what's going to happen when the bill comes?
Right.
He ended up being my lawyer. But Tony ended up, because of his same relentless hustle, Tony was the executive producer and owned both Catch Me If You Can and iRobot.
Dang.
And he was straight hustler. So I learned a lot from him because you looked at Tony, you like, man, you know, how he got meetings with those people was hustle. He didn't even have he might have had the films, but he didn't sell them back then.
Right.
So he was straight hustling too. So I learned a lot from him too, as well as I started to mature, that you have to be relentless because there's somebody who, and especially back then, there was somebody who could look at me and relate, right? James Woods once said to me, it's better to be young and aggressive than old and pushy.
That is a good one.
So back then, if you're young and pushy, people look at you and say, man, I can relate to this guy. You know, that was me back then. So I took advantage of the fact that, you know, that people could relate to you because they were once you. However successful they are now, they once had that same fire and spirit that you had, you know? So
now you got to take this fire and spirit and now you're trying to share it. So talk to me a little bit about the goals of the docuseries, the things that now come back to you full circle, the rewards you get from it that are different from acting, different from making music.
Yeah. You know, and I think it does come full circle because once again, what I learned, my uncle once said, if this life is just for me, I don't want it.
Right.
So right now, when I look at the state of healthcare and I look at how many, you know, sick people are out here who don't have the support, you know, you talk about diabetes, there's almost little to no information on diabetes or support for diabetes anymore. Why? Because they don't need to. If I have the only gas station within 100 miles, I don't need to advertise it. People are going to come. Pharmaceutical companies know that there are going to be millions of people who are going to be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes every year. They're going to come to us. We got the medication, right? They don't have to push it. I'm working on a menopause series right now. Menopause has almost little to no advocacy. And you're talking about, which blows my mind, because you're talking about how many women are CEOs and executives and running ad agencies and running big, but there's no money. There's no one who has created something like a television series to really bring out the whole situation going on with menopause.
Right.
If you look at sickle cell or prostate cancer, I mean, prostate cancer is taking everybody out.
Right.
You know, dementia. You know, when's the last time you've seen an ad or a commercial or something for dementia? Because, I mean, either we're going to suffer with it or someone we love is going to suffer with it.
Yep.
And there's little to no advocacy. So I kind of feel like I'm the Martin Luther King or the Malcolm X of what I'm doing. And it's been really good because, you know, I'm working with folks who are flying from Dubai to Singapore to you name it, because they believe in this little dream that I got of creating these series.
Love that.
You know what I mean? And it's like, we're doing something right. You know?
So what's kind of the metric, or what's one of the ways, you know, or I shouldn't say, you know, but you can feel that your advocacy is working, is making a difference. How do you not feel like you're Sisyphus pushing the stone uphill?
Well, I don't try to, you know, before I used to spend a lot of time, you know, and this was consuming, and I felt like I needed to try to save the world.
Right.
Now I'm happy when I, you know, I just looked on my YouTube and somebody said, Charles, thank you so much for making this. You know, you've changed my life. I hear that so many times. That's what's important, that we focus on. Even my cancer series, you know, that took five people who were living with cancer. One was terminally ill, 6 months to live. Now all are NED, no evidence of detection, years later. And I was able to pull two or three of those people in there that were able to have a second chance at life because of this treatment that they do in Mexico with hope for cancer. So when you think about that, even now, the other day I met one of the ladies and who was on my first series and she was like, Charles, thank you. You know, you literally gave me back my life because she was dealing with, you know, serious diabetes and now she's totally changed. So that's the impact that, you know, that you look at and you say, you know what, it's working. You know?
So when you see things like that, especially that are quite different in on international stages than what they are in the United States, do you think that the reason why the landscape is the way it is here is just because this is the, for want of a better way of putting it, this is kind of the capitalist trap that we're in, or this is just the ignorance that we're all living in now. And we're just kind of come to accept all this because we don't realize X is making us sick and Y is making us sicker.
You know, I think that it's a worldwide problem, right? Because if you look at that, if you look at, you know, India's highest rate of diabetes in the world, you know, I think really, and all of that is the trick too as well. But I really think that at times we don't take our life as serious as the gift that it is.
What do you mean by that? Physically?
Yeah. Health is everything. You know, I mean, you know, don't we want to live to a nice ripe age? You know what I'm saying? I mean, do we want to get sick at 45 and dead at 50? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I got some kids that I need to live for. I've got some travels that I need to do.
Amen to that. Both.
There's some things that I want to accomplish, you know. I didn't come here in vain, you know. And I think that people don't take their health as serious as they should.
How do you think we got to that point? That seems like such an oxymoronical thing to even be able to say, well, I don't take my health as seriously as I should, as if you had anything if you didn't have your health.
Yeah.
So how do we get to the point, do you think, that we really need to try to advocate more for health? How do we even get to this point?
You know, once again, I think that, you know, the other day I was driving, I saw a lady overweight, you know, you could see just driving, you could see how overweight she was, smoking a cigarette. And I'm just like, wow. You know, I mean, how important is life to you at this point? You know, you're overweight.
Right.
I'm sure you're eating all kind of McDonald's and Burger King and everything like that, smoking cigarettes. It's not good. It's not good. What value is your life to you? This is a gift. It shouldn't be taken for granted. You know, so I think that if we, you know, and the tides have turned. If you look at the amount of people who are on YouTube getting millions of views because they are preaching about all this healthy stuff, if you see people who are following keto or carnivore or you know, all of these big names who are, you know, showing people how to live their best life now, people are looking past the traditional way of medicine,
right?
And they're saying, you know what? No, I'm gonna eat like this. I'm gonna exercise like this. I'm gonna train my mind like this, right? How many gurus do you have who are, you know, pushing people and kicking people and telling them, yo, get your life together, go make money, get your body together, get your mind right together, look like something. So I think that the tide has turned. Those who don't want to learn, maybe won't ever learn. You know, but I think that there are millions who actually, you know, want a better life. And that's a great thing, you know?
Right. And I think I hear you saying that you're not only the relentlessness, but the self-discipline are two big key ingredients to better your life. And I know through your advocacy and lots of things, that's ultimately what the goal is, try to help people be better them.
Yeah.
What do you think is the big cotter pin to that? I know it's easy for people to say, well, you just need to be more self-disciplined. Well, you just need to eat better. But what's the thing that you feel comes before that so that people can actually just do those things?
Vanity. Well, I remember when I was diagnosed, I literally went home. I was terrified. The girl who was with me, who took me there, I didn't even tell her what the doctor said.
Oof.
Because I was so scared. But I went home and I looked in the mirror. And I looked and I said, holy crap, brother, you look like crap. You know what I'm saying? I said, you know, I need to lose 30, 40 pounds. So it was vanity that made me say, I got to get back to what I used to be. Mm. I need to get back to that, right? Because how many times we look on Facebook, we went to high school with some people and we're like, dude, what happened to them?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, everybody's done it. Everybody's done it.
What happened to them? And if those people said to themselves, dude, what is happening to me? And they had some vanity, the vanity would move them to, and not, I don't mean it in a bad way.
Right.
But in a way that makes you say, I need to be my best me again. And so it was vanity that made me have to say, I need to be my best me. And that started me to losing the weight, changing the diet. And then also, once again, living for other people, not just for myself, because I had work to do and I still have work to do.
Amen to that. Yeah. How was that in the beginning? Taking on a diet, taking on things after you get this scary, oh my God, my body is not a forever thing. How was that in the beginning?
Well, it was interesting because I didn't know what to do. I was so ignorant to this process. And I went online looking up stuff and nothing made sense. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? Number one, I'm going to stop hitting the gym. Because I was one of those guys who, you know, lifting weights and had a big belly.
Ah.
And I said, I'm just going to do cardio. Started doing cardio, walking. And then I tried to figure out a diet. I didn't know what to do. But I said, you know what? I'm going to do God's diet, per se. And God's diet was just lean meat, staying away from any processed food, some vegetables, and water. And I want to say within 30 days, I probably lost like 20-something pounds. And that was like the start of everything. And
then that wind at your sails, you're feeling that.
Yeah, that was the start of everything, you know. And it's still a journey. I mean, you know, I had in the past, you know, diabetes, cholesterol, you know, hypertension.
Right.
Reverse all of that. Not so much the cholesterol, because cholesterol is a big myth. People need to look into that. That's stay off statins. Anybody listen to this, do not take statins to lower cholesterol. High cholesterol is actually a good thing, to be honest with you. It protects the heart. But there's a lot of information out here that people really need to look into. And, you know, we even now, those same no's that I experienced back then, I'm experiencing now. Right. Because, you know, like I said, when I look at some of these conditions and I think, man, we should be knocking a menopause series out the box.
Right.
We should be knocking a dementia series out the box. And you keep getting a nose and you're like, this fuels me even more, because I don't understand why there's billions made in these conditions. Right. So I might say I'm looking for $500,000, right, to do a series. But yet Astellas, who's a big company in the menopause space, has no problem dropping $14 million on during the Super Bowl. And you're like, dude, if I just gave me 300,000, you know, 400,000, I could change the game, you know? So it motivates you, because you're like, I got to accomplish that. I got to climb that hill. I got to get over that mountain, because people need it. And I know what it could do for those people. So,
well, that makes me think, when you have these people who potentially have the information or are good vehicles to disseminate the information, and they choose to allocate humongous budgets to one thing instead of the other, it kind of makes it so the balance of information out there is just craziness. Yeah. You got people talking from every side and everyone's an expert now, especially in the field of health.
Yeah.
So in your personal opinion, what's a good way for people to know what's valuable information and what isn't just taking a word for it and taking the statins, per se?
Yeah. I think you have to find a balance of what really works for you. Number one, you have to educate yourself. That's key.
Yeah, I'm more worried how you do that. How do you know what's good information and what isn't? People can be very convinced with bad ideas.
True. Because if you look at the opposite sides of the spectrum, you have people who, let's say, are into veganism.
Right.
And then you have people who are into carnivore.
Exactly.
A lot of this depends on your body chemistry, what works for you too as well. Because carnivore is amazing for some people, right? One of my series that we did, a keto series, mm-hmm. a great series we shot in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. And in the keto space is a lot of carnivores.
Right.
And when I first heard about it, I said, man, these people are crazy. You know, bacon and eggs and steak and, you know what I'm saying? They're gonna kill. But as I started to educate myself, I said, wow, this makes a whole lot of sense. And I went carnivore, reversed a bunch of things, you know, lost weight and my numbers were fantastic. Why? Because I wasn't taking in the carbs, the starch and the sugars.
Right. Right. So we're just talking about playing the biochemistry game a little more effectively.
Exactly. You have to find what works for you. For some people, you know, vegetables is it works for their body chemistry. Didn't work for me. But carnivore kind of works for me. You know, I'm kind of between keto and carnivore. But I think education and really, you know, getting this information, because the information is out there.
That's what I'm saying. This is the crux, though. Sometimes it's too much information.
It is. But I would rather... you know, sit and watch YouTube videos and try to decipher between, you know, what is what and what you have tried before. And that may not work for you, because there's a lot of people who do carnivore who used to be vegan.
Right.
And now they went carnivore. They're like, listen, man, everything has changed.
Exactly.
So I think that you really kind of, but the wanting is the key. You know, the wanting to change, the wanting to get that information is the key, because how many people, you go to the buffet and you know, one of these places and the plate is like this big and they think they still didn't get enough.
Right.
So there's a lot of people who aren't even concerned with, you know, what they're eating, you know, and the outcomes of that. So for those who are striving for that, man, you know, there's information, and you could decipher that information and get the best information out there for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's get you out of here on something maybe a little more fun, a little easier, because this is a lot to digest. We got to have you back for some more digestion, no pun intended. Mm. But let's get out of here something fun and easy. What's the next thing on the horizon for you? What you got coming out that people should look for?
We got a series on longevity we just shot in Costa Rica that's being edited right now. Beautiful series. I'm launching a new website. It's called The Longevity Shops. It's going to be a hub for everything health, but turn it into a community. I'm also working on creating a longevity shop that will be in airports, right?
Oh, cool.
So it'll be healthy, because, you know, when you go through airports, there's never anything per se healthy to eat.
Unless you want to just eat the fruit and call it a day.
Exactly. So we're going to have, you know, healthy wraps, you know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, healthy. We're going to have vitamins and supplements and things. We want to be able to educate people, especially, you know, urban people, on the need and the necessity to supplement. But, you know, once, you know, collect information, collect data, be able to bring people to products, to devices, things that can help them, whether it's infrared to the cookbooks, you know. But also at the end of the day, come get yourself a nice jerk chicken wrap and a lettuce jerk chicken wrap and a nice shot of lemongrass or something.
There you
like
go.
That, you know?
I'm in for that.
Yeah, yeah. So that and just, I'm at a space where I'm just enjoying life right now.
Amen to
you
that.
Know, I'm just traveling and I'm not chasing anything. You know, we work hard, but it's really about, you know, living my best life right now. I'm trying to retire per se and do maybe a show a year, you know, and just enjoy the ride. You know, I've hustled enough.
I love that. Enjoying the ride is the name of the game. I'm with you. Well, Charles, whenever you get these next things jumping off, you are more than welcome,
brother,
back.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful to have had you here and so grateful to have heard from you, my friend. Thank you so much, man.
I hope I brought something to the table.
Oh, I have no question.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.